Welcome, everybody, to the Nerd Hour. We've got the full crew this week.
We do.
Yes.
That's right. We've got, of course, myself, Punchy, along with Ariel.
And, hello.
And Cornax.
What's up?
We are here to talk about nerd stuff for, well, for mostly an hour and a half, and then we're going to have our first ever interview, because I don't think we've done an interview before on the Nerd Hour.
Not with me.
Not in general, I don't think. I don't think we've done any interviews on this show before, but just because usually we're too late for a lot of people to call.
I think that might have happened last time.
What do you mean?
The one I was setting up.
Yeah. Well, like, talk to her again about it, because, I mean, we could always pre-tape.
All right, yeah.
Obviously. That won't be a problem. I'll do what I'm doing and borrow this number so she can just call it and record an interview, and then we can do that.
Ta-da. Yeah, that could work.
Yeah. Dude, you should have told me that earlier, because then I could have just said that before and we could have done it earlier. Now, there's a few, you know, there's actually a decent week as far as what we typically talk about on this show. And New York Comic Con is next week, so we're going to have a bunch to talk about before our first ever interview with Howard J. Ford, director of The Dead and The Dead 2 India. Now, you know, it's probably going to mostly be a meat interview, but I'm sure you guys are quick enough to think of a question or two as I'm going. So I think you guys are adept enough. First thing, though, the big one we got to talk about is the fact that Breaking Bad has ended after 5 seasons. What were your guys' thoughts on the finale?
I loved it. I literally thought it was the perfect finale for that show.
It really was. I found that
up until JJ Stoner went, "How do you get the rice in the stevia packet?" And I went, "Fuck."
Oh, goddamn it, JJ. But like, in yes,
there's probably a logical explanation. Like maybe he had his own fake stevia packet they shoved the rice in into?
Or no, it's easy. He went and he picked up a stevia packet, dumped it, put the rice in it, and then resealed it.
Okay, yeah. But it's not that hard. Eating stuff for that?
What?
It isn't. Never mind.
No, he did it before because they're meeting in the same place that he met with her.
So he right. knew.
So he knew she was going to be there.
All right. So what? Okay.
But
I was thinking it was a sleight of hand, quick job, and I couldn't think of how to do it.
No, because actually, if you see the beginning of the scene, he's sitting to the side. Like, you can see him. He's sitting there.
The funny part, though,
which I didn't notice the first time I watched it. I only noticed it until the second time.
Yeah. Then again, I don't think anyone noticed that until the second time that he was sitting there.
Yeah. It's just, like, the whole episode is just him places, and you don't see it. And what I really loved about the finale is that it made a point of the wreckage that he's caused all these other lives.
Yep.
And now he's just in the background. And he's not as important, and that loss of power sort of signal, like how in the first episode, like he's coughing, he has the cancer, and nobody's noticing him, and it's the same thing as at the beginning.
Yeah, it did kind of have a going full circle feel to it.
Yeah.
And I just, despite the fact that he died in the end,
I loved that. I thought that was the only way that it was going to end.
Yeah, but despite, the guy had, like, terminal cancer, so you knew that was going to end that way, but...
Well, and the way that he died, though, was...
And despite the fact that he was discovered as being Heisenberg and just everything fell apart, he still accomplished what he set out to accomplish.
I like that he died surrounded by his empire.
Yeah.
His legacy, because that's literally the only thing that he's ever really...
Done that he liked.
Cared, yeah. And I also especially like the scene with him and Skylar when he's there and she's like, "You have 5 minutes." And then he's talking about, he's like, "I did it for me." He's like, "I did it because I liked it. I was good at it."
And the fact that, like, he really was the guy getting the credit for it. Like, it wasn't like Grey Matter where he got screwed over.
Yeah. And I loved when he went and saw them.
Oh, yeah. They deserved it.
They made you think he was going to kill them, but he's like, "Listen."
And it was just Badger and Skinny Pete.
Well, I say they deserved it because obviously Walt is the bad guy. But it's like, are you really, really going to poke a bear with a stick?
Yeah.
That's all they did with that interview. No, all he did was come up with the name. He did nothing. Really? He's a dangerous drug lord. He's killed countless people. You really want to piss him off?
Tread lightly when you're talking about Heisenberg. But, you know, really, I got to point this out, too. Like, again, he set out to make sure that his family was hooked up. So,
yeah.
Or at the very least, his children. And he, when he went to their house, he ensured that they would be forever hooked up because, like they said, there's no way he could have given that money to his family by himself. Even if they wanted it, they weren't going to take it.
Yep.
They couldn't take it because then they would just lose it, and then thus everything he did would have been for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he found a way to get that, to have that happen so that at least he could leave something for them, but yet in a way where they know, where they don't know that it was his drug money.
I feel like cooking meth was sort of Walt's Fight Club, if you think about it.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Sort of at the beginning, he's emasculated, he's impotent, he's living this life that, you know, is kind of just limp and flaccid.
He's working,
and then he becomes Heisenberg. And he's got this empire. He's got this power. He chooses if you live or die.
Pretty much.
You know, and I kind of like how it's sort of interesting if you look at throughout the series. Because when you think of the series and you think of him as dealing meth, he's bald throughout most of it. If you look at the beginning of the series when he's Walter White, just no Heisenberg, no nothing. He's got the mustache, he's got the hair, blah, blah, blah. And then he becomes Heisenberg, and he's all scruffy, but he's bald, and blah, blah, blah. And then you have the ending, when he's Walter White again, but he's been so scarred and torn and just ripped apart by Heisenberg. He's got the hair again, he's got the beard, whatever. But look at him, he's all worn down and scraggly, the hair is a mess, the beard is just left out to grow.
Yeah, and the funny part, too, is his death comes at the hand of his creation.
Well, it also, what I like is that he went in, like, going to kill Jesse and all of them. And then when he saw that Jesse was a captive, his only sort of, not redeeming act, but sort of his whole thing, this wasn't about redemption, it was about a satisfaction.
Yeah.
Where, like, he wanted his revenge. And then when he saw Jesse was captive, him saving Jesse is what got him killed.
Yep.
Like him, and after all of that, after all of the things and the manipulation he's done with Jesse, I love that Jesse finally was like, do it yourself. Where he's like, you want me to kill you? He's like, no, do it yourself. And then he just throws it down. It's like the best moment. And then Jesse just goes away. And I'm so happy he lived.
Yeah, Jesse was like, anyone who watched The Wire, Jesse was basically the Slim Charles of the meth game.
He was the one that you wanted to live and wanted to seek it out and have a life, and you're just like, ugh, like, all these horrible things have happened to him.
Now he can finally have that life.
Sort of, kind of. He's gonna, I mean,
now he can finally have his crappy movie.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll be in the Saul Goodman spinoff.
It's a prequel series. It's not really gonna be.
Let's be honest. The Need for Speed thing for Aaron Paul could work. I mean, there's not many ways you can mess up a driving game being turned into a driving movie.
Just turn it, with that game, you could just easily turn it into a Fast and Furious type movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. But at the same time, really? Need for Speed? We're really making a movie out of Need for Speed, and you're really going to move from Breaking Bad to this? Come on. Come on.
It's for money.
Come on, bro. Come at me.
No, but, like, with that finale, though, like, what I liked, the song at the end, too, was, like, just perfect. I feel like.
Yeah.
And just him, like, I don't know. It's just, like, it was just so good. And it was kind of an epilogue. Like, it wasn't really, like, the true ending. And there's an article I saw on IGN that said the top 10 Breaking Bad episodes.
That's, we're actually going to be talking about that too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, so, and then the, like what they mentioned, which is actually the number one on the list, is they mentioned that that is actually what they would consider the true finale. Like in any other show, that would have been the finale. But then, like, that these, the last two episodes, like, were more of an epilogue, even though they were the ending. Because his story really ended when he left and went into hiding.
Huh.
Which is a good argument. Like, I would argue that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, they couldn't really end it there because then you'd have everyone going, when's he come back? Are they going to make a movie? Are they going to make it? Are they going to do this?
No, no, I mean, yeah, no, I understand. It's just like, it's more of like, that's the ending of his story, and then this is sort of the epilogue of that story, is him coming back and finishing it.
And now no one can write any sort of lame fan fiction ever. Cough, cough, bullshit, cough.
Oh.
What?
I'm sorry. One of our segments might have been dashed by Warner Brothers, but we'll get to that in a second. Oh, no, never mind. But we'll get to that in a second. Oh, no, yeah.
Uh-oh.
But we'll get to, you know, again, we'll get to that later. I want to talk about the top, what they call the top 10 best Breaking Bad episodes.
And I would argue a lot with this list, but then also, it's one of those shows that you can't really make a top 10 list of, like.
Yeah, all the episodes are usually great. First one, they, number 10 is Face Off. Now, explanation. Do you remember that split second when Gus walked out of Hector's room and you thought ever so briefly that maybe he survived? How inconceivable was that? And then how hilarious was it when you were right back, when you were right to think it was absurd? Face Off was an extraordinary episode from top to bottom, albeit very fast-paced. It had a lot stuffed into it, partially because with the show's future uncertain, the writers weren't sure if this would be the last episode we would get. Because of that, it didn't quite land all the punches it wanted to.
No, it did.
Yeah.
That episode was as close to perfect as you can get.
Yeah. No matter, though, Gus was an elegant character and deserving of an ending as poetic as the one he got. Even though we saw it coming a mile away, it was just as good as promised and one of the finest deaths of any character on TV.
And you have to give props for the Walking Dead crew coming in there. And with those effects, come on.
Oh, they actually did get the Nicotero group?
Yeah.
I can see that now, thinking about that and looking back at that. Next one, number 9, 51.
It's a good episode.
Director Rian Johnson, who did Brick and Looper, deserves a good deal of credit for his help.
He also did three of what I would argue are the best episodes of Breaking Bad.
Yeah. At its toughest points, one with a spent budget, Fly, and one with a...
Fly is one of my favorite episodes.
...character adrift, meaning 51. Johnson put together two amazing episodes that were not only interesting, but gave insight and perspective into a series that needed it at that moment. And his third and final Breaking Bad episode will appear on this list as well, they say. 51 gave us a keen insight into Skyler. Skyler, at her most desperate, did something desperate. She jumped in the pool in a fake attempt to drown herself, or maybe it was real. We'll never really know. Her conversation with Walt in the bedroom afterward was maybe the most powerful scene in the series. While many other people are going to remember quotes like, "I am the one who knocks," I'm going to remember Skyler's panicked, "I don't know. I will count every minute there away from here, away from you, as a victory."
Yeah, that was all. I think had the same conversation where she was like, "I'm waiting for the cancer to come back."
Yeah. And then they go, "As someone who's always loved the dialogue on the Breaking Bad, that scene was like peering into an actual married couple's bedroom and watching it all unfold, unreal."
I remembered the scene where they had the eggs and bacon in the shape of 51.
Yes. Yep. That's that episode. That's when that flash forwards to 52, I think. Or is it 51?
Well, yeah, because he turned 52 in the last episode, I think.
Yes. Okay, yeah.
Number 8, Confessions. Nothing serious came of Jesse's impotent rage of his gasoline pouring. It indirectly led to Hank's death, but almost everything else did anyway. In essence, it was a minor pawn movement that looked greater than it actually was. However, it was a very good episode in the state of Jesse. He was struggling up to this point with what to do with himself. He was such a critical character and our last hope for someone to have something of a happy ending. He was critical to us. Confessions never lost pace. It started with a slow burn on Jesse's state of being and his insecurities. It matched that pace when Walt hugged him and then said, screw this, and burned everything. Jesse had thought as he had come to the realization that Huell had lifted the cigarette, which meant Walt was lying all along, which meant he was probably lying about a lot more. This was Jesse's greatest moment. After a year and a half of abuse and manipulation at the hands of Walt, he put the pieces together, just when you thought he might get out of the show safely without ever knowing. We're all rooting for this to happen, too, the scene of his realization, particularly the direction where no words are spoken, and it's relying heavily on Aaron Paul's acting ability was spectacular.
Yeah.
Number seven.
Oh, wait. I just want to say, I love that whole scene where Walt has the DVD where he blames everything.
Yeah, on Hank.
And it's in the age of the internet, that's kind of such a troll move to do, where you're the one who's the problem, but then you spin everything so it looks like the other guy's the asshole.
Yeah, and honestly, the fact that Hank didn't tell anyone in his office made him look worse.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it was going to ruin his career either way, but it was sort of like that frame up would have sailed.
Yeah. Number seven, Crazy Handful of Nothing. In a way, this is the one that started it all. We knew from the pilot episode that Breaking Bad had tremendous potential. It was Crazy Handful of Nothing, though, that showed us how well the creative team, from the writers putting the ideas on paper to the actors performing it to the directors guiding it on screen, could capture a moment. Walt's first real fuck yeah moment was gorgeous. It was a major triumph. When he threw the fulminated mercury, the camera slowed to half speed just to show us how beautiful it was. The explosion was bright and brilliant. He had felt most of the episode that Walt and Jesse had hit a brick wall and their plan was going to fall apart before it even started, despite having the goods. Tuco's treatment of Jesse was cruel and made the explosion and injustice that much sweeter. At his most desperate, Walt showed Tuco what Will really was. It was the beginning of Heisenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And episode number six, Salad.
Salud.
Salud?
Yeah, salad.
I don't know.
Something that Punchy doesn't eat.
Actually, no. Now that he's on DDP yoga.
I do the juicing.
Oh.
I do the juicing. But
the juicing? Okay.
Yes. Probably the easiest placement on the list. Gus meets with Cartel. Gus kills entire Cartel. Mike wields some piano wire and strangles the dude. Gus nearly kills himself with poison.
That was the best. Oh, my God. Those last 10 minutes were amazing.
In terms of loose ends, Salud was probably the weakest episode in the series. Where were the police in this one? What happened in the aftermath of the Cartel? Who filled the power void in Mexico? It didn't really matter, though. Salud was made for riveting TV, and I'm glad they didn't try to answer these questions. It would have taken a great deal of time to show it, and in the end, it would have proven inconsequential. But what made this one so good was just how the action hit us. The Cartel has always been violent, so guns and shooting sounded more likely. To see Gus execute such a deadly plan so quietly, so strictly, and so patiently was a great reward for all his viewers. Those last 10 minutes were completely worth it, and even if it wasn't as nuts and bolts tight as some of the other episodes.
Okay.
All right, makes sense. Bit by a dead bee. Do you remember how hard it was for Jesse and Walt at the beginning? Bit by a dead bee is a good refresher course. Jesse and Walt escaped Tuco and realized they had to come up with stories to explain their disappearances. Walt showed up in a market in only his underwear while Jesse faked shacking up with a prostitute and a bunch of meth for a few days. It's tough to say what made this episode so great. It weighed everything the series had done to this point and used 45 minutes as a time to reflect on where they were. Jesse and Walt had to come up with elaborate stories for why they went missing, which were as tenuous and unbelievable as you would imagine. They worked, though, because other characters didn't believe their stories, and the episode was about narrowly escaping, just as they had narrowly escaped Tuco. It could have easily turned into the writers dusting their hands and moving on, but it didn't, and this is the first time we saw just how talented this writing team was. This episode is anchored by three shots of Walt looking at a painting. The painting is of people on the shore waving goodbye to a person on a boat. Each time he sees it, he's reminded of how he could leave his family. It's heartbreaking, and it's the first time in a while we see Walt again as the man he once was. He wasn't strong or angry or demanding or crazy. He was just a desperate man about to die, and he wanted to live. In the episode that followed, Bit by a Dead Bee, Walt gave Walt impetus to get back into the cooking. But he and Jesse went through hell and back and were lucky enough to make it out alive. The entire episode is a reminder of how painfully and woefully inadequate they were for the jobs they wanted. And then, as usual, the exploration of the psychological impact of what they had done to themselves and their families was as impressive and powerful as any other episode in the series. I almost didn't want them to see them go back into the breach again. But considering they did, I think we're all better off for it.
Mm.
Wow, that was a long one.
Can I just say, just going over a lot of these episodes, what is with this series and Walt in Tidy Whiteys?
I don't know. It does happen quite a bit, though.
Yeah. Like, Bit by a Dead Bee, he's in the supermarket. And only... Why? The most famous thing.
Because that was him trying to say that he had, like, blacked out and had no idea what was going on.
Well, yeah, but then the most famous image of that show is just him in a shirt and tidy whities.
Yeah, all right. That's the first season cover.
Because that was his like chemical. Like the whole point was him not to get it so his clothes wouldn't smell.
Yeah, that was the number four. 1 minute. This was the start of the action. We had moments in the series before 1 minute that were absolutely gripping, but nothing ever matched the tension this episode had. It was sudden and direct and in our face. The action in 1 minute was almost straight from a movie. Hank, with some thanks to his PTSD, snapped directly into action as soon as he spotted one of the cousins behind him, pinning one of them between his car and the one behind him. The rest was gorgeous, thrilling action sequences that gripped viewers long after the axe struck itself into the asphalt next to Hank's head. There wasn't a wasted shot. What a rush. What made this episode and the action so sharp was nobody saw it coming. We saw Gus mentioning to cartel members that he had an alternative for the cousins, and that was about it. It had made perfect sense for them to go after Hank, too, and for Gus to give Hank the warning. It was win-win for Gus. As for the episode's place in the series, it was the first sign that an action scene could be executed so perfectly within Breaking Bad. We got more later, but this was an outrageous, wonderful example, expertly directed by Michael McLaren.
Mm-hmm.
Episode number 3, Hermanos.
Oh, Hermanos.
We always knew Gus had some intense backstory involving the cartel, ever since he was the negotiator to get the cousins off Walt's back. It wasn't until Hermanos that we learned the full details, which were about as cruel as we had imagined. The difference between this and every other episode was how those facts were presented. We saw Gus finding Hector in his wheelchair. Both of the cousins dead, Hector's family line ended with him. The cartel would be two episodes away from being finished. Here came Gus, all dressed like he had just got off of work as Los Palos Hermanos. He was calm and patient and held his hands in his lap. Hector couldn't move and was forced to listen. This is what comes blood for blood, sangre por sangre, or whatever the...
Sangue, poor sangue.
Yes, I don't know Spanish. cut to a flashback of Gus and an early business partner meeting with Don Eladio and Hector for the first time in Mexico in the late 80s, even though Gus's suit looks mid-70s. The scene started potentially warm and friendly, but took a threatening turn when Eladio started asking why they were selling biker crank in their territory. From there, the scene became a ticking time bomb. It finally went off with Hector pulling the trigger on the business partner. Yet, it still shocked the heck out of the viewers because the focus was on Gus while the partner was talking. The lack of audio was startling as Gus lunged at Hector, and when Gus was pushed into the ground and forced to look at him at the blank, dead expression on his partner's face, you realized Gus had been waiting 20-some years just for the moment to sit across from Hector, knowing he sits as a lonely, crippled old man with nothing left in the world. Cut back to Gus sitting in front of Hector, and his plan has come to fruition. It was delicious. It took some fortitude to wait some 25 episodes after the introduction of Gus to show us that brief insight into his history. Of course, this was about as much as they had ever shown us into Gus and his background. It was part of what made Gus such a fascinating character.
I loved Gus. I thought he was one of the best villains. But also, like, Lydia was so interesting, too.
Gus was great because of his demeanor versus... He was ruthless, but he was... You know, he just had a
calm... But he was so, like, proper, and he had, like, this...
And he really was, like, the best as far as concealing himself from his dealings.
Yeah, and he was so, like, everything was so put up.
And, like... The best way to phrase it is, Gus is what Walt became.
Yes.
But at that stage...
Not really, though, because Gus was much more tactical. Walter was smarter.
He was what Walt wanted to be.
Yeah.
Or he saw himself as Gus, but he really wasn't.
Number two is ABQ.
Mm-hmm. Which has the plane crash.
Yep. At number two comes probably the most misunderstood episode at the time of its airing, with a slight nod to Fly.
I loved Fly. It was
fantastic. While we were all expecting some kind of greater punishment upon Walt, the producers and writers wisely decided to make his punishment far more obtuse. Jane's death didn't affect Walt or the viewers much, but it affected the people around her. The plane crash ending, along with all the shots of the pink bear in the opening of 737 Down and Over, was an intense buildup. The crash itself was a metaphor for the eventual karmic retribution Walt would receive, and also pointed out just how oblivious he was to creating the very disaster he caused. It foreshadowed much greater things for Walt. It showed the viewers just how good this creative team was. They were geniuses for this. They would only top themselves one more time all series. In retrospect, I should have given it a higher rating.
Yeah, he's stupid.
And the number one Breaking Bad episode, according to this reviewer, Ozymandias.
Yeah, Ozymandias.
Mandias.
Or, I think that's how you say it. I don't know.
It's been said so many differently in so many...
That dude like, from Watchmen.
Yeah, the dude from Watchmen, sorry. But also...
While Granite State and Felina functioned as an episode of sorts, tying up some crucial loose ends, Ozymandias was Breaking Bad's real ending. There was nothing this show built towards more than the disillusion of the White family. Walter had done so much behind his family's back that by the time the cat was out of the bag was in the river. There was nothing Walt could have said or done to fix the situation. And God did it pay off. Directed by Rian Johnson, Ozymandias was the cataclysmic event of the series. There were times when the action was ramped up and we were satisfied with the fallout, but there was nothing that even came close to how good this episode was. Certainly, other shows could have picked up from the Toheli ending and kept it going, with Hank and Gomi in the Alamo-type standoff fighting off the army of the ubiquitous neo-Nazi bad guys. I don't think any other show would have blown past the action to get to the point of it, though. The creative team showed not the violence or the battle, but what mattered most, the aftermath. The first 10 minutes were so much more powerful than showing any actual violence, besides the tragic final bullet to Hank, of course. Walt then turning on Jesse was just as painful. Walt fleeing and Skyler and Walt Jr. turning on him was even more painful. It was also personal, down to the shots of Jesse looking at the birds in the air with the gun to his head, and the simple, awkward physical fight that Walter and Skyler had. The episode was a grab bag of hair-on-fire action. The White family dissolved, the infighting, Walt Jr. finding out, a knife fight, a baby kidnapping, everything wrapping up in Walt's vanishing. The lone wolf ran across the screen to tell us that this was indeed the end of the five-season journey. It never lost place, it didn't stuff too much in, it didn't lose focus, and it burned everything we've known from the past five seasons in a crisp 45 minutes. It was the perfect painful ending for a series that was so destructive, and we still got two terrific episodes afterwards.
Yep.
Yep. I'd agree with that one.
I still think, like, there's other episodes that should be on there, too. Like, you can't do a top 10. You have to just rank them all.
Yeah, just 1 through 10, all episodes from all five seasons should have been their list. Because I don't think I saw a bad episode of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I don't. I honestly don't think. I mean, I've seen ones where I'm like, okay, but like, I'm like, oh, all right, but I still don't. I've never considered them bad. It's more just me going like, oh, all right. I mean, this one isn't as exciting as the others, but I'm like, I understand what they're doing with it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's, again, there's never been an episode where I'm like, oh, this sucks.
All right, next, we're going to do a couple shorter reviews.
Well, what do you think is one of the best episodes that you've seen?
Wow, one of the best episodes I've seen?
Like, that's not on this list, let's say.
Not on this list.
Like, what should be on this list? Like, if you were going to rank it.
Wow.
Not even, like, a top 10, but what, like, if you were even just like, you know what, like, these are some of the best episodes that I've seen.
Shit, there's been a lot of them.
I know. Like, I would argue Fly.
Yeah, I would argue Fly as one of
because
them.
Because for an episode that's essentially a bottle episode, and it's just that one room, and it's just Walt and Jesse, and yep, that's all it is. It's so well done, and the symbolism of that episode is so great. Like,
well, I think one that wasn't on the list, and I think that should be, even if it's not on any sort of list, it should be considered a great episode, just for sort of what it started, it would be the pilot.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of what it created.
Yeah. Yeah, that would definitely should be on there.
Shit, I'm trying to remember. Trying to remember the episode name.
What happened in it?
Oh, yes, you know what? Full Measure was the name of it.
Yeah, Full Measure or Half Measure. They're both so good. Is it Half Measure is the one where it ends with him shooting the dealers, right?
Yeah,
that are going to kill Jesse?
It ends with Jesse shooting Gale.
Yeah, Full Measure, yeah. And then Half Measure is the one where he runs them over.
Yep.
Oh, that was so... Both of those episodes are so fucking good.
Yeah, and let's face...
Dead Freight also.
If you're looking for an episode that had the greatest impact on the end of the series, Full Measure had the greatest impact on the end of the series. Because if it wasn't for them having to kill Gale,
Walt probably would have died.
Well, not just that, but... Well, all right, say they did it another way. He wasn't shot right at his apartment. Hank doesn't get the book. He doesn't see the log where the WW is written.
Right.
And therefore, when he sees the book in the bathroom, he doesn't remember back to that log. So, you know, so a lot of the things don't happen in season 5 if this episode doesn't happen as was.
Right.
So this
is what's so great about it.
Even if it's just for how key that episode is.
Yeah. I would also say Dead Freight is really, because that has got to be the most stressful, like, 13 minutes of my life is watching that heist.
Yeah.
Of my television watching career, those are the most stressful, like, 15 minutes of television that I've ever watched.
Wow.
And then that ending, you're just like, oh, like, with Drew Sharp.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Ugh.
All right. So we're going to shift gears to other reviews. Ariel?
Yes.
Since you're the only one who saw this, because I didn't get a chance to because other stuff was going on today, how was the second episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
It was excellent. Well, I enjoyed it.
Nice. Elaborate. What did you enjoy about it?
Well, like, I like how you can see sort of the characters are solidifying on their, like, place in the team. You got a little bit more on Agent May, which was interesting.
Nice.
And, like, obviously, we haven't gotten into anybody's, like, real backstory yet. Which that won't come till later anyway in any show.
No. Yeah, much later.
Like, because obviously, like, they've set up, like, obviously these tragic, like, backstories. Or, you know, with, like, Agent Ward not really having a family as they did in the pilot. And how, you know, but... So they, the whole mission was, they had to go to Peru and they were called to investigate an 084, which is an object of unknown origin. And it turned out to be a Hydra weapon, which was interesting because I like that they're including all this stuff. And then there's actually a line of dialogue where, Skye is talking to Coulson, and she's like, what? And he's like, the last one turned out to be pretty interesting. She's like, what was the last one? And he's like, a hammer. And so I just liked the references. And so they also did this thing where it's a post, they're doing post-credit scenes now on some episodes. And so this week, so you got more into like the plane and what's all on there. And it was just a typical, like, get a little bit of Coulson's history, and we're investigating this thing. This is our first mission as a team. They're not really getting along. And then they all come together for a common enemy. It's basically the Avengers, but in a TV shortened version. which is fine. It's good. There's a reason that storyline works. And it was sort of forcing them to work together as a team, finally. And I like how they refer to the scientists, like Fitz and Simmons, as, like, the children on the bus. And they're like, they're not cleared for combat. And she's like, now you want to add a third, like, which is Skye. And then so what you learn by the end of the episode is that she's in there for a reason, like, that she's working with the Rising Tide still, and she's just giving them information.
Funny, well-liked, smart characters. Yeah, Joss is just waiting to kill those guys off.
He's waiting to kill at least some of them. I'm waiting for it.
He cannot wait. Either Fitz or Simmons or Skye.
Well, I don't care if it's Skye. That'll be fine, but...
But then thinking of how Buffy was, where pretty much Buffy was a comic book character, if you think about it. She died.
She'll bring him back.
She died. She came back.
I'm 90% sure somebody is going to sacrifice themselves, and then they're going to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coulson was already resurrected, technically.
It'll probably be Skye. It'll probably be
That's
Skye.
A good point. Coulson is already back from the dead.
It'll probably be Skye, though. She'll probably sacrifice herself and save everyone. Please don't kill Fitzsimmons. I'll cry.
Fucking Red Sox. Red Sox goes, so I heard this turned into a MLR versus Mix thing. No, it's not an MLR versus mixed thing. Now, I got to explain to Ariel. Oh. We were talking, more shit came out after who's in the chat.
Because Jack is a faggot.
Everyone, like, Hammy was having to be adamant that it wasn't an MLR versus mixed thing. Dutch called and told Hammy to stop saying it. We got him the first time. He doesn't need to keep repeating it. And now it's become a bit of asking if it was an MLR versus mixed thing.
Oh, okay.
So... All right. I can't wait to watch this episode. One episode I did get to watch because...
Oh, wait, no, but I didn't get to the best part.
Oh, all right, sorry.
No, so they're adding... So, like, they call the plane the bus, and anyway, so, like, they do the common enemy, and then something blows up out, like, a hole at the side of the plane, so everything's, like, fucked up and everyone's falling out. And then, so they do some... They fix it and they solve it. Save the day. Everything's good. They throw the 084 in, like, some rocket, which gets, like, shot off into the sun or something to get destroyed. And it's like a Hydra weapon, which I think is fantastic. I'm so happy they're including Hydra, and they mentioned Captain America. But so, basically, so they're doing post-credit scenes now, and fucking Nick Fury shows up.
Oh, shit.
Samuel L. Jackson.
I told you they would bring someone. Someone big-named into this.
I'm guaranteeing that stars of the Avengers are going to show up in random scenes, like other people. They're going to show up because it's just too good not to.
Trust me.
And I love
they're
that
get their highest ratings the night Robert Downey Jr. just decides. Yeah, I think I'll do this today.
Yeah, I love that it doesn't feel like its own from the universe that's in the movies. Like it feels a part of it. What's so great about it.
We'll know if it's even more of a part of it if everyone shows up in the second movie.
Yeah, I would love if they just cameoed. That would be amazing. But you don't even need to be a part of it. It's just, oh, we need a weapon. Oh, here's Fitzsimmons giving you a weapon, like...
Against Ultron.
Yeah, and it's like the fact that Ultron, like, it's going to be mentioned. And anyway, so he showed up, and it was a great scene because they're just arguing about, like, Nick Fury's like, what the hell? He's like, 2 days you've had this plane, and you've destroyed something, like, on it. And he's just mad, and he's like, I don't even know what you're doing with this. And then... My theory is that they know that Skye is undercover. They have to know that she's going to sell information to, like, her terrorist group or whatever. Nick Fury even said he was like, she's a problem. And Coulson's like, I know. And he's like, you need to watch her. He's like, I know. Like, it's like his whole thing. It was great. The whole scene was, and Coulson was like, they act under my authority. And he's like, don't talk to me about authority. Like, And the Tahiti thing, I don't know. There's something up with that.
One of my favorite parts in the first episode, though, was the whole truth serum scene.
Yeah, in the pilot.
Yeah.
That was great.
And next review, me and Ariel saw this one, this week's Sons of Anarchy. I know Sean mentioned something about it in chat, so pretty big episode.
It was very important as far as moving all the pieces forward, and I'm guessing the Irish are the villains again.
Yeah, which, like, again, is a bit of...
I guess they were always the villains.
Yeah, always kind of were, but now more so.
But they haven't been in the spotlight for a while.
Poor Phil.
Oh my god, no. I can't.
Like, one of the more likable characters.
All proxy Phil.
Huh?
All proxy Phil. He says yes. That was my favorite line of that episode. It's almost as good as, like, I just like lines where you're like, okay, it's not necessarily like this badass line. You're just like, it's just the way that it's delivered and the part context of the episode. You're just like, I love it. And that was like my favorite line, just like in Breaking Bad. My favorite line that Marie ever said was when like Hank had Jesse over and was like, oh, this is Jesse. And then she was like, I'll heat up some lasagna. Like, that's my favorite line. Like, because it's just like, it's like this determination. You're like, it's not anybody even saying, okay, yeah, I'll do this. I'm in. It's them saying I'm in without having to say I'm in.
Sean thinks the Irish and Tara are going to be the villains for season 5. But like,
with Tara, I don't see her as a villain. She is trying to get out because she does not want to go to prison, and I see that. I understand that. It's like a shade of gray.
Yeah, she's gonna try
to 50 shades of them.
Yeah. Well, fun fact, no.
Her and Wendy are just fucking holy shit.
I knew Wendy was up to something.
Yeah.
And Tara, obviously, is trying to get out, so you knew that she was doing something. But I wasn't clear. I'm like, are they working together or aren't they working together? They're probably working together, but I don't... It's unclear. And I think, like, I see her side of it. I would understand why you would want to leave.
They're probably trying to get the kids taken away from Jax. Is probably
yeah, thing. And that I understand that because... And specifically Gemma, because she even refers in that episode as my kids, and you're yep. like, whoa.
And I think what really made it sink in was Unser.
Yeah, and he's like,
what if the kids sure. were here?
Yeah, and that's where she was like, that's it. Like, that's where the resolve is kind of, like, I don't see her as, like, the villain. I think the Irish is what's gonna...
Although, then again, though, I feel like Wendy's playing both sides.
I don't know what the fuck Wendy's doing.
She might be
She's trying to get her son.
Yeah. I think she's waiting to see which one is more beneficial to her.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. Like, she's and right now it's with Tara.
But I have a feeling that Tara's going to eventually want to take both kids.
Well, she is the only Wendy has no custody, no chance of getting Abel unless Tara or Jack says it's okay. Yeah, and right now Tara's saying it's okay.
And Sean's right. Gemma is going to go nuts.
That's where it's going to fucking lose it.
We're going to see an epic one-on-one brawl between Tara and Gemma.
I am so happy. That was like my favorite thing with like the early seasons was them verbally going at it and then like them taking shots at each other. Like it was like finally like.
And then they became just the bad biker bitch club.
Yeah, and you were like, okay. And then, like, but that was, like, my favorite thing was when they, like, hated each other, like, in season 1.
Yeah.
And Tara was, like, not afraid of her. That's, like, the best thing. And then you're seeing Tara become her, and then in season 6, she's like, no, I'm not doing this.
One thing that shocked me about this episode, not because of how it was done, but the fact that they did it when they did
it.
So early. Mm-hmm. Killing off both Otto and Torek.
I mean, you knew Otto was coming.
Yeah, Otto was, yeah.
I thought he was going to commit suicide.
Yeah, that's when Clay gave him the shank, I thought it was just so that he, you know, as
he
a
he could end it for himself.
Yeah, so he could just, you know, just put himself out of his own misery. But in a way, he did. But he also killed Torek, the guy who had led to just all the shit he was going through the past few months in that prison.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in a way, it's an awesome scene, albeit a sad one, especially because Otto was, I mean, he was a psychopath, but came off as a likable character in some ways, too. Because Otto was a good representation of the damage the club does to people.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, he pretty much lost everything. And they point, you know, and Torek at one point, I think it was, or the guy from the fourth season, the guy doing the Rico case.
Mm-hmm.
One of them pointed out that Otto's original sentence was 6 years, but it was extended to 30 because of killings he did on behalf of the club in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he pretty much was supposed to be out in 6 years, but then wound up being in a position where he was going to rot in jail.
Yeah.
And then just the physical pounding his body took because of the club. You know, losing an eye, having to bite his own tongue out.
His ass getting a pounding.
Yeah, his ass taking daily poundings because he wouldn't rat the club out. The beating Torek gave him because he killed Torek's sister. And I really, like, I was, you know, it was an awesome scene, but I was also kind of hoping Torek would have lasted a little longer.
Here's the thing. It was getting a bit, like, one note as far as, okay, we see that he's trying to get the clay, to get to the club, to destroy them, to do all this. Yeah, he's doing all this shit to try and get them. But at the same time, like, after a while, you're like, all right, it's enough.
You know what, though? Here's the thing, too. The fact that they killed him off this episode, I thought they were going to have Eli Roosevelt,
I thought he was going to figure it out.
Yeah. And then that was going to be the end of Torek. But in a way, it's almost perfect that Otto was the one who got his revenge.
Otto is the one who kind of deserved it at this point.
Yeah.
I think Roosevelt is now going to realize, okay, he's going to be like, okay, this corrupt guy is doing all this shit, is the one who got Tara thrown in jail, which means her case is probably going to get thrown out.
Yep.
Which means at this point, that puts her in a conflict of, like, okay, is it worth doing what I'm doing now? But I do really like that, like, remember last season, right before she got arrested, when she was going to take the job and go to Providence?
Yep.
And she and Jax had that whole fight about, she's like, if we stay here, all it's going to do is history is just going to keep repeating.
Yeah.
And it's such, like, a good theme for the show. It's, like, the same thing with Breaking Bad, where, like, the theme is established in the first episode, where, like, he's like, chemistry is about change. He's like, it's decay, growth, decay, and transformation, and that's the whole theme of the series.
And you know what? This season and probably next season is going to lead to a falling out between Jax and Chibs.
Yep. Well, he's already fallen out with Bobby.
Yep.
And Bobby's now starting his own
Nomad Crew. Yeah.
Club, like his own. Yeah. His own charter.
Oh, yeah, the Red Sox. My only problem with the whole thing is that now it's turned to them versus the Irish again.
Yeah, and I understand that's sort of like, it's just like a rehash at this point, but like, and I do think that it needs to come full circle again.
And thank you, Sean. Link Potter was who I was talking about.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, he needs to come back.
And Sean's got a point. First time, it wasn't really them versus the Irish. Like, it was them versus...
The Mayans,
but also, like, even in Ireland, the IRA was still backing them and trying to help them in a way.
Yeah, it was more like a couple people.
Yeah.
They were going after.
It was Jimmy O, which is still one of my favorite, like, the end of season three is one of my favorite, or no, it might have been season...
That finale is literally one of the best finales you will ever see.
Yeah. Where...
Season three.
You know, just... Opie and Chibs getting their revenge.
Mm-hmm.
For people who ruin their lives.
Yeah.
Like, it was... If that were the last episode of Sons of Anarchy, that would have been a great final episode.
Yep.
And just... Because, again, the two of the most likable people on the club at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you know, who had been, like, Chibs was scarred on his face by Jimmy O, and then Jimmy O took his family away.
Yep, so that, he was like, I'm gonna...
And Stahl led to the death of Opie's wife, which just destroyed Opie's world.
Fucking Stahl.
What a bitch.
Yeah.
And Stahl...
He's an interesting character, though, but...
She was, but, like, even the wreckage Stahl left in her wake, Like, she even killed her partner slash lover to just keep her story up.
Mm. No, I can't believe that was insane.
But this, like, it's just weird. They've killed a bunch of characters, and we almost thought that Tig was going to be killed.
I literally thought, because I know in the promo they showed a patch burning.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be Tig, and I was like, oh, well, this is it. But then I love that it was, like, a loyalty test, and Jax knew it.
I feel like at some point they're going to find out that it wasn't Clay who killed, who killed him.
Oh, who killed Pope?
Pope, yeah. Again, yeah. Damon Pope, another guy who should have gotten at least another season.
I don't know. I think they killed him at the right time.
It ended perfectly, but he was great. No, you know what? They did kill, and then I thought they were just going to have Lee Torek be the main bad guy of the season. And yeah. But you're right, they kind of did get a little repetitive with him in the first couple
episodes. Yeah, he was just getting repetitive. I was like, okay, I think they got rid of him at a good time.
Which was a waste of Donnell Logue in a way.
Yeah, he was really good. No, but he was still really good, though.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Regardless, it was just like, you were like, this is insane, what's happening right now.
I wish we could have had a little more, like, face-to-face time between him and Jax.
Yeah, that's what I wanted, but I...
show besides a dude named Otto getting fucked in the ass in prison.
Oh, Cornax. But, like, one of the most intense parts of an episode of this season before this new episode was Jax staring into the mirror part of the you know,
yeah, where they were talking.
And what Jax said to him.
Yeah.
Like, before this past episode, that was the most chilling scene of this season.
Mm-hmm.
And we will never get to see that come to fruition. Yet, again, though, it's like... they should have waited a couple more episodes, had Jax show, like, get, you know, find proof that he's been manipulating stuff, and then have Otto kill him afterwards.
Yeah.
But...
I know, I'm kind of under the impression, like, Jax is becoming Clay.
Yeah, it's plain as day that he is becoming just like Clay.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, like... and I think that's what Opie's death led to.
Yeah.
Like, that's the reason he's going to become Clay.
Is that he shut down and then he became Clay. Instead of becoming his father, he's now becoming his stepfather.
Yep. All right, well, Sean has a couple things. Jimmy and Stahl, he says, and then, well, at that point, when they were filming, they hadn't been picked up for a fourth season, which is why they did that with Jimmy and Stahl. So they were going in there assuming that was going to be the last episode. Oh, yeah, you know what? Sean brings up a good point. Cheech Pounder's character is going to be a big problem for the club.
Mm-hmm.
Sacramento is going to want some blood for that school shooting.
Yeah. That I think, is going to be the big issue, though, is going to be that the DA.
Yeah, she's going to
And then the Irish.
Yeah.
This is going to be a war now.
And, like, Sean says everything Jax is doing now is to give Opie's death meaning.
Yeah, which I understand. It's he can't leave now because of Opie.
Yeah, he can't. But now the club's in shambles.
Yeah.
Like,
and he's not doing the right thing.
No, he's not. Like, Opie's death, he's giving it meaning by becoming Clay.
Clay. And you're like, that's not how we do things.
I wonder, though, someone pointed this out in a review, and I completely agreed, that Wayne Unser is a physical also a physical representation of the damage the club does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, between just his physical condition, the fact that he's in shambles, living in a trailer outside of Taylor Morrow, and now the fact that he took a beating from the skinheads and had a swastika carved in his chest.
Yeah.
Like, he is the one who takes a lot of beatings that were meant to go to the club.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Unser. Yeah. He's the guy who, even though he's done some messed up things to cover up for the club, like, he's the guy you feel sorry for.
You do, yeah. He has the cancer, he's dying.
Yeah, you kind of feel sorry for Juice at times.
Right.
Like, he's one of the more likable ones. And
yeah, but then at the same time, he sort of dug his own grave.
He kind of did, yeah.
Like, and then he's just like, oh, I feel kind of bad.
Yeah, like, he dug his own
grave. Like, when he had to kill.
Yeah, but in a way, he dug his own grave, but he had to dig his own grave with the club. Because he was afraid that something was going to happen had they found out who his, what his real father was.
Mm-hmm.
And that should have been a thing, too. Like, that should have been something addressed by Jackson when he became president. Because that would have shown, like, before Opie died, because that would have shown a change, in the club under Jax.
Yeah.
Like, him, seeming more like his father by being a little more progressive compared to what the club was doing at the time.
Yeah.
And Sean says, he doesn't see Jax becoming Clay. Jax is having to make hard calls now, a responsibility you can't understand until you sit in the seat.
Yeah.
I can agree with that. You can agree with that.
I mean, I get that, but at the same time, he's not doing it the way JT would have done it.
Yeah, he's not.
He's doing it the way Clay has done it, where he keeps it to himself, he plays it close to the vest, and he's making these moves without consulting anybody else.
And the only reason...
Oh, and there's a reason people are dying because of it.
The difference between him and Clay is greed. Jax wants to save his club, which will give Opie's death closure.
No, and that's... Yes, that's true. But I do think that his... He's trying to move them into legit businesses. He's trying to make Opie's death mean something. He's trying to fix, something. And he's trying to, save his club, but then at the same time, he's doing it the way that Clay would do it.
Yeah.
Like, he's using actions Clay would take. He's playing it close to himself. He's, people are dying, and he's like, well, I'm going to go kill these people now. Like, and sort of this violence is never ending.
And I'm just glad that now we've got RoboCop in this series.
Yeah, oh, my God. Oh, yeah, he's going to be another issue as the corrupt cop.
Yep, because he's an ally now, but he's going to become a problem.
Oh, yeah.
We know this. He is going to be such a problem for the club.
He already looks like a problem. Like, you just knew.
And he it's funny. He's got that, cop, retired cop look and feel to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just going to be fantastic seeing RoboCop against bikers.
Mm-hmm.
So, this season, there's, again, I think season 4 kind of hit a lull.
Yeah.
Even though big things happen in season 4, but I think season 5 was a step up, and this season is kind of getting back on path there.
It is, yeah.
Sean also loves Peter Weller. Who doesn't at this point? Mm-hmm. So we're going to go on a bit of a song break here. Well, not song break, an ad and song break. We will be back in a few minutes, and we will have one Howard J. Ford calling in during the second hour. And if he doesn't call in during the second hour, if he's late because of his flight, then we're going to just... I'll go late.
Wing it.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of prep left over, so if he's late or if we got to add it, go into a third hour. I did...
Third hour, nerd hour.
Oh.
I picked 9 topics to talk about. We've only been through 2. So we've got prep, is what I'm saying. So we will be back after these words and songs.
Or will we?
Hey, listeners. Yes, that means you. Missed your favorite More Like Radio shows live? No problem. Just go to morelikeradio.com/downloads. That's morelikeradio.com/downloads. More Like Radio's RSS feed works with your iThings, Zooms, Androids, Windows Phone, and anything else that can subscribe to an RSS feed. If you're so awesome that you only get your podcasts from iTunes, you can subscribe to our feed in iTunes by clicking the Subscribe to iTunes link right on the Downloads page. So what are you waiting for? Download More Like Radio podcasts and subscribe to our feed now. Yes, right now. Do it.
Radio professionals, especially Kevin from Alcohol by Volume, marvel as he winds his way through the twists and turns of Skype.
And you're about to get a Skype call back.
Here we go. Answering the call.
So, yeah, not to interrupt this exciting hockey talk, but what's going on, guys?
And call not found, and he dropped me. That's fantastic.
I was under the impression this was a drunk show, not bore everyone that's listening show.
Well, I'm still in the process of drinking.
I think we lost Kevin, or Kevin decided to be lost.
You're still in the process of boring people.
And I just realized I put Dennis on hold somehow.
This is that nightmare that I've been having of at some point finally getting on call and talking to somebody and being on air and everybody else just dropping.
Dennis is back
there
now.
You guys are.
Sorry, Dennis.
Wow, fucking radio professional over here doesn't know how to add people to conference.
Alcohol by volume, Tuesdays, 6 to 8 p.m. only on MoreLikeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Mary Ann from Lust and Love. Recently, we decided the show needed more dicks, so we found the manliest man we knew to fill the spot, Dark Fox.
I know this is weird, but my boyfriend broke up with me because my dick is too short. He praised me about my skills and all, but is this a really good reason for a breakup? Because it's really hurting me until now. I can't seem to forget all the memories we had together. I know this can't be the reason, or maybe because he met another guy. I really cannot get over him because once he told me, I love your dick, whilst he was stroking it. That's the reason I will never let go.
Lust and Love, now gayer than ever. And that's saying a lot considering we used to have Hammy on the show. Join us Monday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern on MoreLikeRadio.com.
Hey, it's your boy, the impact player, Mr. Philly Raya.
And of course, your host with the most, Big JP.
And we are
the Man Cave Radio Show.
Listen, check out our boys, the Sully Show, every Sunday from noon to 2, exclusively on
MoreLikeRadio.com.
That's right. Check them out,
bitches.
You'll love them.
I bet you will.
Yep.
Also, no one needs more about gel coat.
You took my father's life, but you won't take his sword. Thunder. 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 Thunder curse.
Think that I should quit? Well, that's already to hear. But let me ask you a question. Do you think that I care? They might have lost the days, but I got them for years. And I'm sick of their foul shit, just affecting your ears. I'm the greatest to ever do it, like Muhammad Ali. So before you get crazy, you don't want it with me. See, you only live once. That's your motto, nigga. YOLO. So do you really want to risk a stupid nigga thoughts? I'm Amon-Ra's theory. You don't want to see my beast mode. I unwind at you naps like a god toad. Then down a shot of Jack and Johnny Walker Blue. Get in my face and I walk the Texas Ranger fools. I'm not patient, on top of that I'm fucking rude. A foul mouth, with an even fouler move. So when I'm rapping, spitting fire like a dragon, creating this verbal chaos. Can't you hear the fun I'm having?
I've always told the best in the world is my title. It makes them mad like Mum-Ra, it's final. Bringing good news just like switching the Geico. By doing this crap, I'm still making it mine though. I'm on a path to where I still do not know. Thunder has sent me to change the way the world flows. That's why when I'm on the beat, I always let go. I'm kicking ass all day like I was lying.
All that this Michael Bowman is giving me beyond sight. These other rappers are lame and I'm beyond right. I shine bright, I'm telling you, beyond light. I'm too good for real, beyond nice. And these maniacs are fucking lazy. Who fucking signed these rappers? These labels are fucking crazy. Where do they find their fans? I'm thinking they're stupid maybe. But telling them to their face I'm a hater and really shady. Fuck your backwards logic. Always try to pause, change the motherfucking topic. I spit fierce like the boom you hear from a rocket. So don't get out of pocket. Sit down and listen, cause these niggas are not it. I'm telling you they can't be, I'm like a prophecy. So tell me where the talent's at, if it isn't me. Waka Flocka, 2 Chainz and Lil B. Oh really, put me out of my misery.
I've always told the best in the world is my title. It makes them mad like Mum-Ra, it's final. Bring you good news just like switching the Geico. Like tuning this crap, I'm still making it mine though. I'm on a path to where I still do not know. Thunder has sent me to change the way the world flows. That's why when I'm on the beat, I always let go. I'm kicking ass all day like I was lying.
Mainstream needs to change, and I'm the game changer. Coming hard with these strange bars of the Nera. Thunder flow, ho, you know you better get with that. I dare a jackal to challenge
me to a battle rap. So swearing they hard when they soft like snot. Creating these moms that are not too smart. So what's going on? No one has heart. I want to take hip hop back to the start and relay it grow. Back to the days when it was all about the flow and letting niggas know what the government seems to be planning on the low. When they did it in the streets and they didn't care to blow. When they took it slow. You know what I'm saying? I just want to give you more by putting on a show, man. MOA is dropping beats, call them Panther. And when I'm on a beat, they refer to me as Lionel.
I've always told the best in the world is my title. It makes them mad like Mom Robert's final. Bringing the news just like switching the Geico. By tuning this crap, I'm still making it mine though. I'm on a path to where I still do not know. Thunder has set me to change the way the world flows. That's why when I'm on the beat, I always let go. I'm kicking ass all day like I was Lionel.
Word.
Do you like video games? Are you a little antisocial? Well, listen to Antisocial Gamer Radio. Tuesdays from 3 to 5 on morelikeradio.com.
Hey everybody, this is Alexa. You can hear my Uncle Sean say terrible things on the Hippo Juice Show. Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Followed by the Red Show from 9 to 11. And now Mark Out Radio with Big T and Dark Fox is on Wednesday too. Join them during their new time slot, 11 to 1 a.m., only on morelikeradio.com.
Hey, you. Yes, you guessed 10,542. Change your username. And while you're in a More Like Radio live page listening to fine quality programming, notice the banner ad just slightly above the chat room. It's a link to something you want in Amazon. Click it. It's probably reminding you to order something you need from Amazon.com. Don't leave MLR and type the URL like a sucker. Just click the link and it'll open in a new window. This way you can buy your shit and continue listening to the show. Now, change your username. It's right there on the right, stupid.
We're back. The Nerd Hour.
Oh, are we?
Oh, we're back.
It's just an illusion.
Optical illusion. It's a schooner.
Optimus Prime?
Optimus Rhyme.
Optimus Prime illusion?
Yep. So we're back. Again, guys, we should be expecting a call within the next half hour.
BT Dubs, speaking of amazing shows, I watched the Once Upon a Time premiere, and it's awesome.
There's so many premieres that have been happening.
Once Upon a Time is great.
Since you brought up Once Upon a Time, I'm going to bring up the fact that it is one of the many things that are being represented at this year's New York Comic Con.
What?
Like, this is probably not just in scope of how many people are going to be going to this thing audience-wise, because this is probably the first year where tickets pretty much sold out right away.
Yep.
Which, again, supports the theory that I've been saying the last 2 years, that New York Comic Con is quickly becoming San Diego Comic Con East.
Yep.
Like, and now, like, TV shows are starting to do panels there.
Yeah, yo, I'm in a Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. panel. Walking Dead. Teen Wolf has one. Once Upon a Time has one, which I can't see because I'll be in the main stage. Archer, Bob's Burgers.
I'm going to try to hit up the Archer panel.
Yeah, the Archer panel is the first one in the main stage. The Empire stage has, like, Sleepy Hollow and Once Upon a Time, which I'm kind of disappointed because I don't want to, like, rotate stages because I want to be there for the Walking Dead one, and yeah. I can't leave.
I might not even be there for the Walking Dead one or the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. one because I actually, one of the press hours are that during that.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of, like, yeah.
I got a ton of emails, and I've replied to most of them going, yeah, I'll do it. Fuck yeah.
I know.
Because
you're a shameless whore.
That and the fact that the more interviews we do, the more contacts I get for networking, for finding...
Wait, which ones are you doing? Are you doing the Teen Wolf one?
Not at the moment. I didn't decide on that one yet, because I wanted to see... Like, let's see, what did I... I got to get the list together of the ones that I've confirmed, but I'm trying to get an interview with, what was it, with Lloyd Kaufman of Troma.
Mm-hmm.
I got one with a DC artist.
Nice.
I'm going to be part of I'm going to go to Rick and Morty press hour.
Uh-huh.
So Dan Harmon is going to be part of that. I'm trying to get into the Bob's Burgers one because I've been wanting...
That's when I was like, I don't like, do I want to end on that one?
Because I
want to go to that panel.
Yeah, like I just want to say I interviewed H. John Benjamin.
Yeah.
That's what me doing the Bob's Burgers one is going to be all about. I'm trying to get into the WWE Films one on Sunday, their press hour, because A, I think getting to interview Kane would be a big get for on the station.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would be huge. And not to mention how hard it is to get active WWE wrestlers if you're not on their list of approved media.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can somehow finagle that, that would be fantastic. Plus, try to get a picture of Kane in the early process of chokeslamming me. That would be amazing.
Well, yeah, because, you know, he's not going to be able to lift you.
Oh, no, he did it to the Big Show, but that's right, bro.
Guys, fun fact, Aaron Taylor Johnson is confirmed as Quicksilver, and Elizabeth Olsen is confirmed as Scarlet Witch.
So basically, they're going to be in the same movie twice next year.
Yes.
Godzilla and Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
Or no, is he Quicksilver in the Avengers movie?
Avengers, Age of Ultron.
Well, either way, they're still in the same movie. But
yeah, Evan Peters is Quicksilver in Days of Future Past.
That's right. That's going to be so weird, seeing Quicksilver
it's
in one.
Fine. They're different. I consider them different universes.
I know. But
well, still. I'm like, it's fine.
Unless Marvel actually, you know, gets the movies back from Fox and then they combine the universes, then you have to figure out, all right, which one did a better job?
One's Earth 2.
Huh?
You can have one be Earth 2.
Yeah. So long as we get Hugh Jackman, if they ever combine.
It'll be fine. Yeah, the Spider-Man ones are more where I want it, back in the Avengers universe, but...
I am confirmed to be part of the Mob City press hour.
Nice. Oh, that show looks great.
It does. Like, you know, and Milo Ventimiglia is going to be part of that. So that'll be, you know, a decent name for us to meet to do some sort of interview with on the show. I actually am going to a screening of a movie on Thursday before I go.
Oh, you are going Thursday.
Yeah, I'm going Thursday because, A, there might be the Rays press hour with Zoe Bell.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to try to get into that. But also...
Because you're obsessed with Zoe Bell.
Well, she's been in a Tarantino movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But, actually, she's been in the last few Tarantino movies, now that I think of it. But, also, I'm going to be... I got a ticket to see a screening... Well, not a ticket, just on the list to see a screening of Dear Mr. Watterson, which is about Calvin and Hobbes, like a documentary. Nice. So I'll be, like, that starts at 11 a.m., and then by the time I get out, I would then make my way to Comic-Con, and I'd be there in time to chill a bit before it starts.
Yeah.
I don't know how stupid I am.
What?
I hear Zoe Bell, and my mind, it's punchy, and I heard the name Zoe, I immediately thought Deschanel.
Oh.
Jesus Christ.
Hey, when you're going on and on about Zoe Deschanel... Anytime I hear the name Zoe come out of your mouth, that's what I'm thinking.
Me and everyone, every other guy on the planet, you mean?
So Carrie's actually getting released?
Yep.
This year?
Yeah.
Amazing.
We were at that panel.
Yeah, I know, but I thought it got delayed.
No, I don't. No, it didn't get delayed.
It was supposed to be released last year.
No, it was supposed to be released this year.
Yeah, but earlier, I thought.
No, it was supposed
to. You know, it did. It got pushed back.
Well, they probably pushed it back to put it on in October.
They pushed it back because they said they need to, like, reshoot. I don't know.
I don't believe that. But,
I'm seeing Gravity tomorrow, so that's going to be what I review next week in 2 weeks.
For Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, a new 13-part series coming out via Fox, I will be part of that press hour. I'll be there.
I'm gonna be wanting the floor dressed up, so that's all I'm gonna be doing.
Yeah, that's basically you're gonna look at stuff in further review is basically.
That's my job.
That's pretty much your job. Eventually, maybe next year we'll give you a little more involvement.
I just You're not allowed to have involvement.
Like maybe interviewing cosplayers.
Yeah.
Not going to panels, but like interviewing cosplayers because you're snarky enough where it'll be hilarious. And fantastic.
Yeah.
So, me and Hammy do plan on interviewing cosplayers, too. And actually, Dave from Cousin Joe will be... He'll probably be following me around a lot because it's his first Comic-Con. So, I'm like, all right, I'll put him on some of the press hour things. I'm also trying to get onto a press hour for Bad Milo. Just so I can also say I interviewed Mark Duplass. Mm-hmm. So... Fucking Sean. Not even Red Sox says he hopes Kane choke slams me for real. And I can't wait to sit four rows behind you so I can throw shit at you, jerk. We're going to the same wrestling pay-per-view for Ring of Honor. And
fun.
I'm like four rows behind him. So shit's getting tossed at his head.
Nice.
Sean, why does Rey Mysterio wear that bull outfit to the Los Matadores matches? Mm-hmm. And, like, there's other stuff that hasn't been confirmed yet for interview-wise for New York Comic Con. Like I said, for example, Lloyd Kaufman trying to... Like, he said yes. He just told me to email the woman who works for Troma, who's doing his scheduling for that.
Right.
But she has yet to get back to me.
Well, I'm sure she will probably this week. She probably has a couple.
Hopefully
she can. Otherwise, I would email her again and be like, hey, you haven't gone back to me.
I emailed her the second time today. So I'll wait.
Okay, so then wait. And then next week, if she still hasn't gotten back to you, then email again.
Lloyd Kaufman would be a fantastic interview to do.
Yeah.
He just sees...
He's awesome.
Fantastic show-wise, because he has the personality that would be great. It would be a one-on-one interview, because I think what I'm going to do with the press roundtable stuff is that's going to be to get audio to write, like, written content for the station.
Right.
Also to get sound drops and photo ops.
Yeah, that's the best.
Lloyd Kaufman will be one of the actual one-on-one interviews that'll happen. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Jones from DC will be one of the other ones.
Yeah.
So that's... Comic-Con's great, though. I love it. Especially the exclusive they have there.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm like...
The free shit.
I'm really excited. Just to, like, Friday is usually the day where I wander the floor, look at what I want to buy, and buy any exclusives. And then Saturday is my panel day. And then Sunday is autographs, photo ops, and buying a bunch of shit day.
I think Thursday is going to be buying stuff day.
Yeah, I'm not going Thursday, so.
Yeah. And I wasn't going to go Thursday, but the Zoe Bell thing was put on Thursday.
Thursday. Yeah, I know. There's like a Haven panel Thursday, which I want to go, but like I have to work, so I can't.
Oh.
Like, I mean, I could just be like, oh, I didn't realize it's also Thursday, but like I feel bad just being like, oh, I can't come in.
Yeah. And I feel like if Lloyd's representative doesn't get back to me, I'm just going to email him directly. Go, hey, I still haven't heard from her.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to talk to him because, A, again, I want to go to film school so I can probably get some insight. And, B, I think Troma would be a fantastic partner for More Like Radio.
Oh, yeah? Like, are you kidding me?
I don't think there's a movie studio more perfect to do any kind of a partnership with the station than Troma.
I know. They would. They would just be like, whatever.
It would be great.
Troma literally gives no fucks.
Zero fucks to be given. Just like More Like Radio. It's perfect. Almost too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm going to go to the site. Because there's panels I do want to go to, like, the Curse of Chucky panel. Just because I'm a fan of those movies. And I'm hoping there's a press hour.
Yeah.
Because that would be another thing where the main goal would be to get a sound drop from Brad Dourif.
Yeah.
Because, fuck it, man. Chucky, aka and Wormtongue. Doing a sound drop. Okay. And the ponytail guy who gets killed early on in Alien Resurrection.
That's the most awkward credit you could give him.
Alien Resurrection is the most awkward credit you could give anyone.
Yeah.
You know the weirdest thing that happened as far as me trying to email publicists about interviews was the response I got from who I thought was one of Chris Elliott's representatives, where it was just like, he's not my client. She's like, wow, I feel like a gigantic dildo right now.
Yeah.
Like, and that's happened a few times. Like, not often, but it's happened once or twice. And it's just awkward. Holy shit, George Romero.
What?
George Romero is going to be there Saturday.
Oh.
Get a drool mop for Punchy.
I am, you know what? It's funny because I tried to schedule a call-in interview and the guy said he won't be able to call in.
Okay.
But maybe I can get something for, like, at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Oh, man. I'm bringing my Day of the Dead Blu-ray and getting that shit signed.
I remember last year that I met Guillermo del Toro, but whatever.
Yeah, I did too. I had, you know, we had the nice conversation, but George Romero, his, like, some of my favorite horror movies and what got me into zombie movies in general are his first three movies.
Yeah, I know.
So, like, aside from Guillermo del Toro was, like, a good, like, a starstruck moment, I think George Romero is going to be a big time one for me too.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be huge.
Speaking of which, I really want Pacific Rim to be out now, but it's not.
Dude, it's going
to
be, hey, the Tuesday after Comic-Con.
I know, but I want it now on Blu-ray.
Oh, well, okay.
I mean, I can watch it online, I guess, on Amazon, but I'm just like, I want it now. I want the Blu-ray.
It's like, I want it now.
I want now.
I want the Blu-ray of it.
I want now.
She sounds like the overdub they did of Jim Harbaugh in that one video. But I want cake now!
I just want to watch the Blu-ray.
I do, too. Which version are you getting?
The Blu-ray combo pack.
Or the one with the statue.
There's a one with a statue? I literally just looked at what was on Amazon.
No, yeah, there's a four-disc edition with a statue of the Jaeger.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, I need this. Where is it? See this special edition Blu-ray 3D plus Blu-ray plus DVD plus Ultraviolet. No collector's edition.
Guillermo del Toro, but I gotta point out.
I want to get the Tales from Year Zero comic, but is this it? This isn't it. I don't see anything with a fucking statue. Oh, wait, I found it. Oh my god.
Did Bump Monkey just put in a GIF of Kevin Steen pile driving a hat? Yes, he did.
Is that a knee pad, I would think?
It looks like a hat.
It looks like a hat.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome. That and each disc has the different Jaegers on it.
That is one of the, like...
Here's the thing. I want to see what the statue looks like before I spend this money on it.
Well, maybe it'll be at,
That's literally, okay, at Comic-Con, that is what I want. I want a Jaeger action figure.
Are they selling those, or?
I don't know, but I want it.
And you know what's funny? I usually don't do, autographs at Comic-Con unless they're, free signings. But, if Romero is doing...
There's one on Amazon. You can get all these different action figures of the different Jaegers. I want a shirt that says Gypsy Danger, and I want... action figures from it. This is what I want. And I want the Tales from Year Zero.
I just typed Jaeger statue into Google Images, and one of the first images is a statue of a horse's ass.
Fitting that Cornax found the statue of the horse's ass.
Because I was on Amazon, and I just typed in Gypsy Danger, and there's the Gypsy Danger 7-inch deluxe action figure.
And I don't care how long I have to wait in line. I'm getting George Romero's autograph on my Day of the Dead Blu-ray.
Oh, they have Knife Head, too? That's cool. Crimson Typhoon, for the Striker Eureka, and... Oh, I want a poster, too, man. I want this flyer poster of Gypsy Danger.
I may even do the We're Not Worthy to... I'm not worthy to... Yeah.
He'll just look at you.
Shut up, Cornax.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No!
You will...
Is this happening right now?
No! No! No, someone posted a day.
Yes!
No!
Yes! Cornax, you are not what's best for business.
Then you shouldn't have hired me.
I'm doing my my Randy Orton, who's the most boring person in wrestling impersonation.
Joe's just gonna kill you.
Joe is gonna kill you. Sorry. The one of the good things about TNA is when their crowds are chanting, Joe is gonna kill you, at Samoa Joe. But anyway, I digress.
Jason, get your action figure.
Like, one of the coolest, but also most expensive for what it is, exclusive at Comic-Con, they've got a Walter White action figure in a hazmat suit.
Oh, that's cool. I don't want that, but that's cool.
I might get that, because, like, the action figures, like, at Comic-Con, the exclusives, generally, like...
Search, can you see?
Like, is that Kevin Steen in his straitjacket kissing a dude on the cheek?
What?
Look in chat.
Fucking Ring of Honor crowds are crazy. I can't wait for that to go to Final Battle.
So you can kiss Kevin Steen on the cheek?
No, because it's going to be the closest to being into an ECW crowd. Oh, wait, we got a call. Hold on 1 second, guys. Hello, this is the Nerd Hour.
Hi, this is Howard Ford.
Hey, how are you doing, Howard? How was your flight?
Oh, my flight. Well, that wasn't amazing. That's quite a long story, which you might not have time for, given that I missed my connection from Chicago, and I've literally just walked outside the LAX airport now. My producer friend, Mark Andrews, just picked me up, and that's it. I've just arrived. I don't have much of a brain left, so I don't know how good this interview will be.
That's all right, man. This is actually our first interview, so I'm happy to have you on.
All right, well, happy to be here.
Although I'm sure you'd probably rather be resting or something after the hell that you had to go through.
I'll rest well. We can use what tiny little bit of brain power I've got left, and then I'll sleep like a baby.
All right, so I guess we'll just start with a couple of basic questions first. What influenced you to get into film, and on the flip side, what got you into directing horror?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I started making short films with my brother John when I would have been 13 years old at the time. And it was kind of because the thing that did it, well, there were two things really, but the main thing I would say that did it for me was Sam Raimi's Evil Dead. That was, I was already interested in making films. I didn't even know what making films was about back then, quite honestly. I had no idea how to go about it. But then one night, watching an old VHS around at my friend's house in Brighton, England, where I was from. We put on Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead, somehow got hold of a copy of it, and it absolutely blew me away. I was utterly terrified. So no matter what anyone tells me about that film being a comedy, trust me, when you're 12, I guess, at the time, that The Evil Dead 1 was not a comedy.
Yeah, no.
I was well scared. And then Romero's Dawn of the Dead. We watched pretty soon afterwards. We suddenly got the taste for it all. And John and I were both very blown away by that. John particularly, I think he still says it's his favorite movie ever. And we were both blown away by this. So those things put us into horror.
Yeah, and first of all, I got to say, it's funny that you mentioned Dawn of the Dead, the Romero version. I was just having a fanboy moment because New York Comic Con is next week here. And George Romero is actually one of the guests.
Oh, I've met him a couple of times. He's absolutely lovely, such a lovely guy. And he was quite a coup when we had the theatrical release of The Dead One. And when I was last in the States, in fact, I think it was, then he sent a little good luck note for us, which was nice because we tried to reach out to him to see if we might get him to sort of give us a quote or something, you know, like, what he might have thought of the film, but I don't think he's ever seen it, quite honestly, but he sent us a good luck note, so that was quite nice.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about Romero in your movie, and that was kind of what brought it to my attention. So, you know.
Yeah, he's, I don't know if I saw him in Cannes. I met him in Cannes, in the Majestic Hotel in Cannes, and I've got to speak to him. I was more excited about him. There's all these other, sort of famous names around, but that was just one guy I had to go over to. And of course, like probably loads of other people, I stood there going, "Oh, I'm going to make a zombie film," you know. And I think, "Oh, okay, great." And I wouldn't have taken any notice of that whatsoever. He must have a thousand people telling the same thing. So, but he was really nice about it, really gentlemanly, and he's what a guy.
He seems it. Now, I'm going to rewind back a little bit to the first The Dead movie. The one thing that sets it apart, one of the things that sets it apart from a lot of the other zombie movies that have come out is it's set in one of the more exotic locations and probably one of the most against the grain locations you could set one of those movies since Lucio Fulci's Zombie.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, whose idea was it to actually film in a place like Africa?
It was pretty much a joint idea to do it in Africa. It's funny because we were, at the time, we were, there was this zombie movie we wanted to make when we were 13, 14, 15 years old. We wanted to do it back then. We tried to do it. We attempted to make a zombie movie. In fact, at some point, we got a load of costumes, ragged them up, and did all this stuff. And then I had a lot of friends who just never turned up for the shoot. So it never went ahead. There was no organization and no backup back then. We ended up doing loads of TV commercials, and we ended up shooting a lot of foreign TV commercials for all sorts of boring products, which I won't bore you with. But we ended up going to Africa, different parts of Africa, like Ghana, Nigeria, places like that. And we were just in between locations in Ghana at the time. And we said, this is just so stunning, all these places. We're not filming while we're here. It's ridiculous. All these villages, they look great. We should do a movie here. And then we were feeling a bit disheartened because we were doing stuff that our heart wasn't really in. And then at some point, maybe John mentioned, oh yeah, we should do that zombie movie. We never did. Hang on a second, why don't we do it in Africa? So it was really a joint thing at that point. And it was like, and suddenly I felt, or both of us felt pretty excited about the possibility. We thought, okay, that's something that we haven't seen before. Because to be fair on John, he kept saying, all along, you know, we were in between these other film projects, and we were going, you know, we should make that zombie film. But it wasn't set in Africa at the time. But as soon as the idea for Africa came up, for me personally, I was like, yeah, that's got something a bit different. That's a film I want to see. So we just thought, you know what, let's stop all this TV commercial stuff and go and do it. We did.
Now, about the dead, because we're going to get into some of the difficulties you guys had making that movie. The first part was, I was watching the movie again today, and that's actually what I was doing when you texted me earlier.
Okay.
It was ironic that was when I got the text, because I was watching it again to make it fresh in my mind. But,
okay, yeah.
When I was watching it the first time, when I had bought the movie and watched it, like, something had seemed off about Rob Freeman's performance, and it kind of distracted me a little bit the first time. And then I'm watching it the second time, and that's when I found out he had malaria.
He nearly died. This is the thing, you know. It's funny enough, I was even Rob's great. He's a very good actor, and he was literally. I keep trying to explain to people. You're absolutely right. I'm glad you picked up on it. He was nearly dead. I mean, literally, when he collapsed with malaria, we took him to the hospital, and he literally lost control of his bowels, and the whole thing was a mess, I can tell you, not pretty. And we took him to the hospital, and then I was like, God, he's got full-blown cerebral malaria.
Ooh.
And which he may never recover from. And he was put on the hospital drip, oddly enough, in a skeeter-infested hospital, but anyway, he's put on the drip, and the doctor, I remember being in the sort of foyer reception bit, and the doctor came out and he said, okay, well, he's on the drip, and but he may still die within 2 to 3 days. We can't guarantee that. And I'm standing there going, okay, I'm about to kill the lead actor, I'm about to kill people. And I think he was so seriously ill, I can never get that across to people enough. Yeah, he's acting. You're watching him in some things. You can sort of see something in his eyes. His retina's not able to stay focused. He was literally using a lot of energy to stop himself convulsing or literally passing out. Yes, he's acting with full-blown malaria. That and the fact that did not help him at all. I mean, I know his performance would have been better without being nearly dead, obviously. but also, there was to be fair on Rob, because he's a great guy, and I don't know if there's anyone else who would have continued to make our movie in those circumstances. Was the car that he was driving around in, and unfortunately had a lot of dialogue in, was such a noisy car that we could not use any of the dialogue at all from that. So we did ADR. We replaced all the lines in post-production. So, and that was, you know, very hard to get
it's very hard to get a decent performance out of ADR, no matter what your budget is or who your actor is. Never as good as you do it in post-production. So they suffered a bit from that. So it's a little bit unfair on Rob, and I've seen a bit of criticism for him. But I honestly know, you know, there was one scene in particular that's now cut from the film because he literally, that was when he finally collapsed, and it was really no good. But I was there when he did the original audition for it. It was such a great piece. It almost literally brought me to tears. It was that good. And then here's a man on location in Africa who literally can't even stand up anymore. Very, very sad. It's a shame.
Yeah, that, like, I commend him now knowing that he still went through the shoot. And, wow, like, I was in awe when I read that. I couldn't believe that. And I was like, you know what? Like... because a lot of people did give him shit when they saw the movie. Like that was one of the knocks that a lot of people had on the movie. But then again, a lot of people on the internet, they kind of just, it's anonymous, so they can just say shit and not have any consequences.
Oh, yeah, everyone's a critic on the internet. Which is interesting.
And listen, like, everyone's guilty of it. Like, I've been guilty of it a few times, but, like, It wasn't even that hard to eventually even though it took me a while to find out about that. It's not really, I mean, a quick Wikipedia search would have told anybody who said that what happened and would have probably changed their perspective. Now,
yes.
Now you guys also had problems getting, like, with your gear breaking down there.
Yeah, we had, I mean, everyone broke down and the gear. For the other thing, I mean, literally, the dead. I mean, I've written a book called Surviving the Dead, which is out now, you know, it's out now in paperback. You can get it on Amazon and all that stuff. And it literally, I've given the detailed blow-by-blow account of everything that went wrong on that production, because a hell of a lot went wrong. We literally couldn't, it took us about 5 weeks to get our equipment into the country. We had our kit in the port of Hema in Ghana, and we literally could not get the gear in. And so we had the cast and crew in hotels and everything, literally for a 5 week period before we even start shooting anything. And at that point, when we finally got the gear in, was when Rob got malaria, and then we all got severe food poisoning. And I got on the first day in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, I got mugged at knife point.
Jeez.
You know, literally two guys with hunting knives took all my cars, my cash, it was, and then we got held up by police, by armed police, almost every day, certainly every other day. And, it was hell on earth. I mean, John and I look at the dead. We like it because it's kind of a piece of what we wanted. But really, we would have had so much more out of that film, had we just had half of what we wanted.
All right, and my follow-up to that, too, would be, with the sequel, what steps did you guys take to prevent that from happening again?
Well, it was interesting with the sequel, because John and I knew we would have problems going back. And you know what? You know, we're obviously suckers for punishment, because we haven't chosen to do it in our own backyard again. We've gone to somewhere we've never been before. We've gone to India, obviously, as you can pick up from the dead. To India, and by the way, we might drop the two. We might just start going with, if we're going to keep doing this thing, if people still want it, we might just kind of, you can watch them in any order, really. So what we've done, we tried to find the most beautiful and interesting country in the world, because we thought, visually, we have to outdo India. I mean, we don't want it to suffer from sequelitis and just be bigger, but we kind of wanted everything to be up here, you know, a bit more exciting, a bit more action as well. But also the landscape, and India seems to be the most beautiful place we could find, and it is. But if anyone is listening has actually been to India, logistically, it's a fairly difficult terrain to work in, you know, hustle, bustle, very difficult to shoot stuff in the cities, which we did. We had to do it with hidden cameras, because the moment people see a camera, they're all over you, you know, staring into your lens, you just can't get them out. So there's a lot of sort of hidden camera stuff in there as well. And we had, you know, we had issues. I mean, they're lovely people and everything else, but we were filming on location, a more harrowing scene near a rail track, the movie that you'll see, hopefully a particularly disturbing scene. And actually, at the time, we had these goons, what they were called, like thugs, that turned up and they ripped the camera off John's shoulder and off my shoulder and literally, they threatened to stone us to death. It's like, okay, here we are again. But because we'd been on the dead, the whole crew were like, oh, this is like a shoot. We've never been on, and John and I said, you guys, you just don't know. You don't know anything. We've been on the dead. That was just like being prison, being raped on a daily basis. Probably would have been more pleasant than shooting the dead one, I would say. So yeah, it was like kind of having a chance to go back to the school bully, knowing the school bully is gonna come at you with something, and we kind of had our answer ready. So John and I made this plan at the beginning, right? If this goes wrong or that goes wrong, which it will, we're gonna do this instead. We're not gonna stop. We're not gonna be beaten down. We're gonna continue. It was like a Terminator. We absolutely would not stop until the Dead 2 was made, and that's kind of how we went about it.
What I like about the series is because you're doing the different locations, you could pretty much just say everything happens within the same time frame, which, like you said, makes it so that you don't have to watch the one first to watch the other one.
Absolutely right. You've hit on exactly. This is a discussion, you know, we had before we went into shooting. We thought, okay, we want to do right by the people who like the good one. We want to give them the flavor again. We want to give them, in fact, there are links in it. It'd be interesting to see who picks them out or if people pick them out. We've thrown some things in there that are definitely links from the Dead One, which if you haven't seen the Dead One, you will never get. So there are advantages to seeing the Dead One, absolutely. And there are nods. I mean, there's a whole thematic nod, without giving too much away, about the relationship between a boy with no parents and who's left stranded, and the American engineer, and something that unfolds there that is thematically something that, you know, you might want to see after seeing the Dead One. And so we explore that, but we explore it in a different, so you can't, we can never be accused, hopefully, of just doing the Dead 2 is just, oh, it's just like the Dead 1 except with a different name. I've even seen that comment on the internet, but it absolutely isn't there. That was the whole point, to make it completely different. It was a tough decision not to do Africa again, but hey, not that tough given all the issues. But yeah, so basically, you don't have to have seen the Dead One to see the Dead Two, but it is an advantage. You'll get things that other people won't get while you're sat there. But we needed to stand on its own 2 feet, and hopefully it does that. It is a different film. You know, the pace, we've given people the same sort of flavor, and there is this contemplative moments and moments you can think. But I think the horror audiences are much more intelligent than non-horror audiences realize. There are these contemplative moments, and hopefully it's a little bit deep. By the time you get to the end of the film, hopefully you feel something in your heart, but actually it's quite a bit more action-packed, quite a bit more fast-paced. So hopefully some of the slow moments in the Dead that bothered some people, those issues shouldn't be there this time around. But hey, you know, we can't please everyone. We've tried.
It's virtually impossible to please everyone. And I didn't. Yeah. And one thing I'm going to point out is you guys had mentioned that Dawn of the Dead was one of your big influences. And in the way you presented the sequel as being unrelated to the movie, yet still being related by the common, the outbreak happening, it's almost like Romero's movies, because with the exception of his last two, each sequel was never a continuation of the other one.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is a very good point. And yeah, and I think that gives you a bit of freedom to kind of take people on a bit of a new route. I mean, for example, you know, yes, there's some things in it that I'm interested to know. I'm very curious for this screen fest next week, because this is our first screening. This is the US premiere on, you know, next Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. And I'm very interested to know, because John and I have made the film for American audience. It's made for Americans, and we are Brits, so you know, we cannot always be sure we get that right, but we were inspired by American movies growing up. Those are the movies we saw that got us into this business, and that's what we grew up loving. So that is the audience. You know, in England, there's like, you know, there's 7 or 8 of us. One of them is the Queen. She doesn't watch London movies. You know, we're a small little island. America is the audience. But it has to work here for us. So fingers crossed that people get what we've tried to do, really. I mean, there is a bit of, you know, crossover of a genre. We've got a familiar story we've put in intentionally about a forbidden relationship, without giving too much away, between
a local Indian girl and our American girl, you know, the foreigner, is out in India working on wind farms, wind turbines, and this sort of thing. They're 300 miles away from the girl who's fallen in love with. And there's a sort of been relationship thing, which is hopefully, most people will have seen that thread from many other movies. Almost every Bollywood movie, for example, has a bit of that stuff in it. But that's the point, is that we wanted to take some things that were slightly familiar to people and they go, okay, but you've not seen this with a zombie outbreak. You know what I mean? And that, and just put people in the context. We give it the dead one, but you say, hang on, I haven't actually seen this before. No matter whether you like it or not, and hopefully we've done that with the dead too. You know, you haven't seen this because we've chosen locations in India that no other movie filmed at, apart from one or two of the bigger things that you know, that had appeared in other movies. We literally, if we went to a location and it had been seen in another movie, we wouldn't select it. We just completely stayed off the beaten path. So you'll have a new experience no matter what.
Oh man! And another question I had too, going back kind of the first one, but also since you guys aren't going to do a continuation of that one, what do you guys envision having happen to Brian and Daniel's son?
Yeah, it's funny because we both had slightly different ideas on it. Because to us, it was, I mean, some people really liked the end, some people did not like the end, thinking it. Maybe it didn't have an end. Actually, to us, it did have an end. That was about fate and karma, and that was what was meant to happen. And my feeling, and I've not even said this before, but you know, my feeling was that they were going to, but he was going to get his sense of purpose back again, and he was going to fight to save this kid. He had a reason to live again, to do right by the guy that, you know, Daniel saved him, the father of the boy, and to sort of, battle together. And then, in fact, without giving too much detail, there was going to be a big, in fact, we very nearly, because we did start writing, continuing that. That was one of the things we did. And then we're going to back into the building that you see them at the end. There's going to be a lot of, you know, quite a big action set up around that. The radio, they were going to be able to get, while they were sort of hauled up in that place, they were going to get someone on the radio, someone who was also in the beginning of the film, was an actor we really wanted to work with again, who you would have assumed would have died in the crash, but we were going to have, actually, he'd found an aeroplane, he found a plane in Africa, and he was radioing Brian Murphy from that crappy old radio in the other room, while they were hauled up in there, they're gathering numbers around, and then that became the mission to get to his colleague from the plane, who had no engineering experience, but had found a plane that he felt could work. So then him and the boy are going to go to this particular place on the map, potentially get to somewhere else from the plane. That was going to be the plot. If I can heal up to you again, yeah, I'd rather have that. But there was a lot of reasons in the end, and we took on a lot of, you know, we listened to a lot of feedback out there. We did our best to sort of, kind of do something that, but we also didn't want to kill the mystique. We didn't want to kill the mystique of Brian Murphy. And that sounds weird, but when you see a character in a sequel, all of a sudden the sort of way he was in the first one, or he or she, doesn't have the same sort of feeling about them. Had we, you know, it's almost like an artist, a singer or something, that, you know, when they die, everyone suddenly thinks, yeah, they're great, and they want to buy their record. But whereas if they live, they just, you know, get a bit fat and old, and everyone gets a bit bored of them. So we didn't want to kill the mystique, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, completely, because in a way, people would want to know the ending, but like what actually happens to them. But in some ways, it would add to it. In other ways, it would take away from the ending as is in the movie.
Exactly right. But there is a possibility. Now here's the thing. And then obviously we're going to be very carefully listening out. If people, you know,
look, if people don't want us to go to these exotic places and nearly kill ourselves to give you a different zombie movie, please tell us now. We'll stop doing it. But if if people want it and they're encouraging and they go see it, they go get the DVD or whatever happens, they go see it at theatres, and we start to sniff that people want more of it, then there's something else up our sleeve. But it's not impossible that you have seen the last of Brian Murphy, actually. But there's a couple of possibilities we're talking about at the moment that would be... I don't want to say too much because obviously people haven't seen The Dead 2 yet, but there is a possibility of something that could happen that, it might be very, very interesting for part three. But let's see. Let's see how that goes. I don't want to say too much about that, but nothing's impossible at this point.
All right, I've got a couple more before I throw to my co-hosts to see if they have any questions. Now, if should you guys do a third one, do you guys have any places in mind you would want to film a sequel to another The Dead movie?
Sure, I'll give you a couple of that we do. We have a couple of possibilities that we thought was interesting. One maybe a bit controversial, but the first we're thinking China because it's massive. Imagine the with the amount of people in China, that sort of outbreak, and that could be interesting to us. But we had a bit of a controversial one. We thought, well, how about The Dead Afghanistan? And bit controversial, I know, but the plot of that could be incredibly interesting. But I'll leave you to think about that one. But it's those things that came up for us.
Well, controversial and just a little more dangerous in some ways than Africa, probably.
Yeah, probably even more so. But if we want to actually do something, if we did it, wherever we do it, we'd have to actually go there and do something. And then, otherwise, we want to give people the authentic experience.
Yeah, and going full circle, because you had mentioned being a fan, watching Evil Dead and that and Dawn of the Dead. Did you end up waiting until it was, they finally did away with the whole video nasties thing, or did you wind up having to do like tape trading?
Yeah, that whole video nasty thing. Yeah. Do you know, my brother, John, did a lot of, tape trading. In fact, we got the hold of the band list, the original, band list, and or mainly John, really. He started collecting, kicking everything off. And I think he got every single thing on it as an original VHS or Betacam, I think it was at the time. Except one. I can't remember what time it was. Yeah, everything on the... It might have been the Beast in Heat. I mean, just one thing you didn't get. There was a lot of trading. Because that was annoying. That was kind of frustrating for us. But it was frustrating and exciting at the same time because... Yeah, these things were taken off the shelf when we were starting to become interested in them. But then it was great when someone had got hold of one. Okay, wow, I've got this one. Yeah, I've got hold of Thriller Killer, whatever it was that that particular weekend when we were watching horror movies. It was making it forbidden made us want it even more.
And that's true. Like, the more they try to censor, the more interest it creates in it, and yet they still will... even here in the U.S., it happens a lot, where, like, there will be a big fuss over something that happens in a movie or a book, and people say, oh, this is immoral garbage, this shouldn't be read or seen, and what happens? A huge spike in sales.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. As soon as people say something's forbidden, yeah, it's like anything in life, and anything in life at all. You say someone can't have it, it's a forbidden fruit, absolutely. Yep, it is. And, yeah, it's one of the things. In fact, John's got, I think, an idea for a revenge movie that he wants to do. And I think he's potentially could end up being so violent that it might get banned. And then at that point, you can release two versions.
Nice. And it is starting to close to the end of the show. So I'm going to, before I let you go and finally get some rest, Ariel, Cornax, sure. Do either of you guys have questions?
I think it's more of like a thing, like, I appreciate that it sort of shows a zombie crisis on more of like a global scale. Because so typically you get the American perspective or, and sort of, I was just like, I guess I don't know if I really have a question, more of like just the comment that it's awesome that it's not just your typical perspective of oh, it's in the United States or basically like all these other zombie movies do. And was that sort of something you set out, I guess, to be like, we're going to make this different?
Yeah, to make it different, absolutely. Sorry, I'm getting a bad, I don't know if you can hear me clearly, but for some reason, I can't, it's cutting out. I don't know if you're on a different line. Sorry about that.
That's Skype.
I can hear the question clear.
Yeah,
I was just getting pieces of what you said. Sorry, so I think I've missed your question.
No, it's okay, Punchy. Do you want to repeat it?
Yeah, she was basically, it was more of a statement that she had said that a lot of zombie movies, they usually are very centered in the United States. And if they're not, a slim portion or outside of the U.S. are set in, like, England, which, you know, Shaun of the Dead and Cockneys versus Zombies.
Yeah.
But, like, she said she appreciated the fact that you guys actually do that type of movie on more of a global scale.
Oh, well, thanks so much. I wish I had heard that. Really appreciate that. That means a lot to us to hear that. Because sometimes, and I have to say, it's only last week when, you know, there's been a hell of a lot of encouraging comments on the internet. But sometimes you get comments that are just, you just sort of look at it and you go, why do we bother? We didn't have to go all this way. And we are doing it to give people something different. In other words, no matter what you think of The Dead One, excuse me, or The Dead Two, you won't have seen anything like it. There is no other film like it. Because no one's gone there. That was the whole point. And it's odd that, and it's great, and I really appreciate you've recognized that, and that's fantastic. And hopefully you're not alone in that. And it's worth us going all this way, because it's so incredibly difficult to get stuff done in these countries. It's so much easier for us to stay in England. You know, I can shoot so easily in the street in England, no problem at all. And you know, we're doing something tough because we kind of want to see this different thing, and we hope other people do as well. So that's great to hear. Thank you.
And Cornax, you have anything?
Yeah, I was actually. A lot of zombie films sort of have their own take on what zombies are like, what they look like, how they move. And what I find really interesting of yours is, like, the most striking thing is the eyes. I want to know how much input did you have into what they looked like? Was this, you know, your vision of sort of the gray, almost ashy skin on the zombies and then the white eyes? Or was that you just let the special effects department just run wild with what they wanted?
Yeah, thanks. No, it's something that actually both John and I discussed a lot beforehand. And when we first, for example, when we first went to Africa, we did a test. We did a test zombie, and we did various things. We did the sort of makeup ourselves, essentially. And I remember John just going over. He came up with a great idea about basically we were going to sort of people who kind of looked particularly. You know, let's say weathered and gaunt themselves, and then we would bring out their bone structure as if the bone structure was coming out of the flesh. We kind of came up with that look ourselves. It was one of the things when we first talked about Africa that excited us the most was kind of also the white eyes against dark skin. It's a great look. It just has the contrast between these things, and it kind of works in the same way in India. Not quite the same, but it is a different look. No, we tried to do it. We tried to get a look ourselves and then present that to our effects people. But there were times, it's really odd, you know, because we went to some villages in India and things like that, and halfway through the makeup, for example, we'd have the white contact lens and everything else. And then some of these people would go, no, I don't want any more. You know, they're in their local languages. I don't want any more makeup. No, I've had the makeup now. And literally people would refuse to go any further. So it was quite frustrating. It was strange. And then we'd have all this stuff going on in local language and we didn't understand what it was and they wouldn't want any more makeup. So we couldn't always get the look we wanted. Sometimes we were, I just didn't want to go any further. Really, really weird.
Well, I really, in this day and age with so much reliance on CGI, I really appreciate that you guys didn't use an overabundance or try to make the zombies in post-production look more gruesome. Just you did what you had with the practical effects, and I can really appreciate that.
Thank you. Oh, that's great as well. We tried to keep everything a bit sort of organic and just do it all in physical makeup, and hopefully that comes through. I have to say, you know, there were times when we did want to do even more of that stuff, and it again, one of the frustrations of working in, you know, you hear the story about Spielberg going for Temple of Doom and getting to India, then no one in the villages will take part in the film because there's a supernatural element to the film, so they left. That's what I understand the story to be. Maybe someone out there knows the real story, but that, and we were in India going, oh my God, this is...
All right, for those of you who are listening to this on podcast or replay, we had technical difficulties towards the end of our Howard J. Ford interview, so he actually was kind enough to let us call him so he could kind of add us wrapping up the interview and so he could get his plugs out. So, Howard, is there anything aside from the Dead 2 that you would like to plug?
Yeah, well, actually, also with the Dead 2, with the Screamfest screening on Wednesday, 9th of October at 7 o'clock, in Los Angeles, of course. We are giving away a couple of tickets actually on my, there's a Howard J. Ford Facebook/ Howard J. Ford, fan page. And, anyone who sort of likes the page, we're going to do a random giveaway for someone based in US, a couple of tickets to the premiere. Unfortunately, we can't pay for the travel, but we'll give a couple away. Couple of tickets away, and other than that, just please, when the Dead Indie comes out, you know, we were so grateful for everyone's support who came and saw the Dead 1, and we'd love it if you come and see this, and we'd love to know what you think.
All right, well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure, and go get some sleep because you had a rough day.
Yeah, but it's been better now. I feel better after doing the interview with you guys, so thanks for that. I enjoyed it, actually. It was nice talking to all of you, and yeah, I hope you like the movie. There's a little bit more foreplay in this one at the beginning, but bear with it, and it gets going, hopefully.
Definitely, thank you. Like I said, a great first interview for this show, so again, enjoy the rest that you very much earned from your flight today.
Thank you. Well, I'm very, very well and truly in the U.S. now, and I'm actually excited about this screening because not a lot excites me these days, but as I say, John and I made this film for an American audience. I'm fascinated, genuinely, to sit there next week and just see what the American audience thinks. If we've got it right, great. If we haven't, oh well, we'll tweak it next time.
Definitely. And all right, guys, this has been the Nerd Hour. Again, thank you to Howard for calling. And have a good one, guys. Guys, no show next week because we will be at New York Comic Con, but there will be a new show the week after that. So have a good one.